From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Jerry Ludwig is my guest. He spent many years in the entertainment industry as a writer, a producer, publicist. He wrote many episodes of your favorite TV shows like Hawaii Five-0 and Mission Impossible, I Spy, Murder, She Wrote, and Columbo. Oh, and MacGyver. Jerry Ludwig's latest book is Blacklist, a murder mystery set in the era of the Hollywood communist witch hunt. Jerry Ludwig, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Good to be here.
And that's all the time we have. No. Before we talk about Blacklist, tell me a little bit about your career in the industry. Well, you're a New Yorker originally, yeah?
I'm a New Yorker. I trained as a journalist at CCNY, and I worked for the AP and then New York Post when it was a decent newspaper and so on, and then graduated and thought, now I'm ready to unleash myself on the world of journalism, and couldn't find a job better than a copy boy in one of the New York papers. So I wound up in the Midwest working on a paper. Then I came to California under the illusion that there were many newspapers in Los Angeles. Actually, there were about four or five at that point. The rest of them were like the Pico Post. They were shopping journals. And while I was looking for a job as a newspaper reporter, I got a job with Hecht Lancaster, Burt Lancaster, and Harold Hecht, their independent film company. And I, initially as the office boy messenger, and I was making a third more than I'd been making as a reporter. So I got the message.
You weren't doing any writing, but you were working in the film industry.
I was, and then within a, I sort of looked around and saw the publicity department, and thought, what do they do? They deal with reporters. I'm a reporter. I know how to deal with reporters. So I finagled into that, and I wound up as an apprentice working on Marty, the release campaign for the Oscar campaign on Marty, and the release campaign on Trapeze, the circus picture, and then started doing that a lot. Worked with Brando on two movies, the only one he ever directed, which was shot along the Carmel Coast. We used to say, it's the furthest west you can make without getting wet.
And as a One-Eyed Jax, right?
That was One-Eyed Jax. Mm-hmm. And too bad, he was a good director, he just wasn't a good film editor.
That movie's a little too long, you think?
It was. There was a sensational 4-hour version which I saw. Today they would release it. They would make it, you know, like they'd make it into a miniseries or something like that. But the studio just sort of waited him out. He had to have a cut down to like 2 hours and change by the end of the first year. And the day he didn't, they took over the movie, and he never directed again.
Well, that movie, for some reason, is in the public domain. Do you have any idea why? I mean, there's no good version of that movie.
It's, yeah, but there are a lot of crappy ones.
Yeah.
Some lawyer forgot to file a paper. You know, I mean, there are several odd pictures like that. There are, some of them are notable. You know, It's a Wonderful Life is public domain.
Yeah. I met Burt Lancaster once, and I was like, it's the only time I ever met anybody that really stunned me. Like, oh, he's so big. He was like a gigantic.
Enormous.
He was like the Statue of David as he walked into the room.
Absolutely.
Well, you got to know him when you were working there?
Very well, yeah. Initially, I used to go, when I was still the office boy messenger, I would pick up film cans and bring the, you know, he wanted to show pictures to his kids up in Bel Air at the house on the weekends, and I would do that, and I would pick him up a couple times a week, and he was always in tremendous shape. And he would run at the track at UCLA. And he convinced me that I should do that. Do not do this with him. He will be better. He was incredible. But I remember one day he pointed out, I used a variant in that in one of the lines in one of my books. He pointed over at Royce Hall. He said, when I was your age, I could lift up that building. And I thought, I was a believer. I thought he could do it today, that day. Anyway. But he was a marvelous man, and also very, very bright, self-taught, you know, not very uneducated, no formal education, but was a tremendous reader, and was a very public-spirited guy. He marched with Martin Luther King in Selma, and was always up for, you know, narrated one of the documentaries about the Hollywood 10 and so on.
As a writer, you've written for so many actors on television. Do you find actors, as a rule, to be intelligent or unintelligent?
That's a discussion that I had going over years with Jack Lemmon, who I worked with as a publicist on four or five movies, and starting with The Apartment and Irma LaDuce and so on. And Jack, you know, good Princeton man that he was, he said, you can't be a good actor unless you're an intelligent person. And I said two words to him. I said, Charlie Bronson.
Yeah, he was a fine actor.
He was a fine actor, but was, you know, not a bright man, really. He was just very, you know, stolid, kind of like, well, he made a career out of that, those qualities. But I think there is, Jack had a point. If you can be a personality, and if you have some personality quirk that's attractive to an audience, you may be able to get by with that for years. But if you're really going to be an actor, you know, then you better be bright, because you better understand what the words mean. And particularly in movies, it's the subtext really that we remember.
Well, so when you were writing for television, just tell us, how did you get into TV from writing? You were a publicist, and then
I was a publicist, and then I became a publicity director, and I was working with the Mirisch Company, who were the major suppliers for United Artists. And it was something novel for that time. It was after the breakup of the divorcement of the studios from the theaters and so on, and television had come, and Hollywood was in a bad way. And it's not unlike the American government. When in doubt, cut. You know, not cut the movies, cut the budget, cut the payroll. So they cut all the actors loose, and at that point, the actors started to make movies. They became the producers of their own stuff. But Burt and Kirk Douglas were really the only ones that were good at it. Then along came Harold Mirisch, who was out of distribution, and he said, I know those thieves and how they work. I'll protect you. But he hired directors, and the first three he had deals with were named Billy Wilder, William Wyler, and John Huston. And this was at Allied Artists, and I think Willie made Friendly Persuasion. Good movie. Didn't make any money. Billy made Love in the Afternoon. Good movie. Didn't make any money. Huston never got to go to the Post because Allied Artists ran out of money and couldn't play out the hand. It's like the guy in Vegas with a system. And they went and set up at United Artists, and they took Billy with them. And pretty soon, well, if you looked at the directory in the lobby, you thought, if a bomb hits this building, it's the end of American films. Billy Wilder, William Wyler, Fred Zinnemann, John Frankenheimer, Blake Edwards, Norman Jewison. I mean, the best guys.
Cream
were
of the
there.
Crop.
Cream of the crop. And I was the head publicist for the company. And for me, there were no film schools in those days. So this was my film school. And I could ask anybody anything, because they thought, well, maybe the kid's going to get my name in the paper or something like that.
Yeah.
And but I got to see process. I got to see everything from the beginning, from the point that they say, this is what we're going to buy this thing, or we're going to develop this idea or something, through everything, you know, through the writing, through the casting. I'd see the dailies. I would see the scoring sessions. And it was truly like a master's class in everything. And along in there, I decided, I want to write. But writing a movie seemed too ambitious, and at that point, an hour television show seemed better, and Naked City was the show that I admired the most at that point. So I started writing for them and sending stuff in. And the first couple they were interested in, but didn't for one reason or another. And the third one they were going to make, and then they got dropped. They didn't get picked up the next season. So I took this as an omen. I thought, all my luck is being used up by getting Shirley MacLaine and Steve McQueen on the cover of Life magazine. What I ought to do is quit this job and write full time. But it worked out. The day that my going away party was going away from that life as a publicist, that morning I got my first assignment to write a show for, there was a show called Run for Your Life with
Ben Gazzara.
He only had 6 months to live, but actually,
show ran for 3 years.
And then but then he ran out. They were right in the first place, and he did die. Mm-hmm. And the show was gone. And everything anybody had ever said about, you know, the tough thing is getting the first shot, it's true. It was like once my agent could say, well, he's doing a show for Ben Gazzara, then this, within weeks, I had an assignment to do the first of a bunch of iSpies, which were very, very fun to do, and also Mission Impossible. Then I was doing both of them, actually, at the same time. And I remember Bruce Geller, who was the creator and executive producer of Mission Impossible, called me in one day, and he said, I notice what you're doing. He says, it's very interesting. You're introducing humor into the show. And I said, yeah. Isn't that great? You know, and like that. He said, don't do that. And I said, why not? And he said, if we start them laughing, we may not be able to stop them. And I thought it was very shrewd advice.
Well, it may be because, you know, like The Man from U.N.C.L.E., when that show got jokey,
yes,
it was very hard to pull back. And
yeah, there is no going back, finally. Yeah. You better take it seriously if you want anyone else to.
Yeah. We're talking with Jerry Ludwig, and his new book is called Blacklist, and we're going to talk about it eventually. And he's also written lots of great television shows and was the showrunner, right, on MacGyver.
Mm-hmm.
You have to say it like that. Did you have whenever they never said MacGyver, they always said MacGyver. And did you have a role in that? Did you say, listen, when you say it, I want you to say MacGyver?
No, I think that all happened with Saturday Night Live.
Oh.
I don't think it was, you know, like that. But we did not only invent the phenomenon, but we used to call MacGyverisms. and it's part of, good or bad, I made two contributions to the language. There's one, and Book'em Dano is the other.
Was that your line?
Yes.
All right. And they use that still in the new Hawaii Vote.
Yeah, they kind of, that's yet another similarity. There are only one. As far as I'm concerned, it's an interesting, fun show, and I like Scott Kahn very much. But you got the big wave coming in, and you've got the music, and that's about the only connection.
Well, we were talking earlier before we got on the show about how television now is so different, because when you were writing for television in the pre-VCR, pre-DVR era, those were shows that each show stood alone. There wasn't a story arc in the same way that almost every show had. There are no shows now that just kind of stand alone.
No, it's unusual. That's sort of like we're breaking new ground. Actually, it's just going back to the old ground. It's come so far forward, though. I think we all agree, everybody's writing about it at this point, that the movies have taken over the circus aspect of entertainment in most of the theaters. And TV is really wrestling with very complex characters and dark situations, and those take longer to develop. And it was a big deal on Hawaii Five-O, we would do two-parters a season,
uh-huh.
and you really wanted those cliffhangers to work. But also, I think that the cable television thing has helped change the audience, because people don't want. God help us, because that's supposedly, you know, the commercials are what pay for the the freight. But you look forward to true crime, true detective. No commercials, and it just goes on, and God, it goes, and it mesmerizes you. And in my day in television, you learn to live with this kind of convoluted
10 minutes.
Dipsy doodle.
Yeah.
It had to go. It was like you'd start, and you'd have to end on a high point, because you had to hold them through the commercials to come back and then pick it up and then start again. And it's a freaky kind of, you know, way to tell a story.
Quinn Martin had Act One, Act Two, Act Three.
An epilogue.
Yeah, that's right.
He was an epilogue guy.
And they didn't really even have a consciousness about season finales or season premieres. It was just
another good episode
of a show.
No, I think that sort of began around the time of Dynasty and
soaps.
Yeah, soaps.
Yeah. Well, now, let's talk a little bit about... Yeah. Well, before I ask you about your novel, did you ever think you could be a director or an actor?
Not an actor. I've done walk-ons and most of the things mm-hmm. that I've done. No, I don't want to do that. You know, I've seen too many really, really good ones to take up that space. I thought of directing, but actually when you gravitate toward the era I was working in, the movie star really had the last word. sometimes it was a good word. If it was Bob Redford and Sidney Pollack, they worked really as a team, and it wasn't, you know, you are my servant or anything like that. But those were really exceptions to the rule.
If it was Jack Lord, maybe not so much.
Oh, thank the Lord, right? Yeah, he used to order people off his island. That was, he was, you know, very... But, well, anyway.
Yeah. Well, so now in your novel, which is called Blacklist, and it's a mystery, and the characters and the studio setting are fictional, but the Blacklist was all too real. How did the Blacklist get started? And do you think there was an element of anti-Semitism to the Blacklist?
Mm-hmm. In the sense that what I knew many, many people on both sides of the aisle who'd been touched by it. And no one was touched well. But it was only in doing the research that I discovered that the Blacklist was really payback. It was because we know why the Congressional Committee came west, because the headlines were in Hollywood, rather than talking about a dentist in Fort Monmouth, New Jersey. But what was in it for Hollywood was the people, of the 10 people that were the Hollywood 10, 8 of them were writers. There was one common thread through it. They were all people who were activists who advocated the forming of the Writers Guild. They unionized the town. And it took a long time, a long miserable time of rejection, because Hollywood was and is a fiercely anti-union town. Anyway, but there was a president. Roosevelt was in the White House. Until the Supreme Court said it was illegal, there was a National Labor Relations Board. The NLRB said, you will negotiate a contract. And so in the late 30s, there was a contract. And as soon as there was a contract for the writers, there was a Screen Actors Guild. And suddenly there was a Producers Guild and a Directors Guild, and so on. And the people that were called before the committee, and that was the handful of people that ultimately went to prison for 6 months for contempt of Congress, they were the people that were the point of the spear that got it, and they were getting back at them. And most writers, many writers in Hollywood are Jewish, uh-huh. You know. So if it doesn't start out that way, it winds up that way.
So the interesting thing that you talk about in your book, Blacklist, is that the McCarthy era, the McCarthy part of the McCarthy era was over, but the Blacklist lingered on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was. I'm writing about it. The committee called the people that became the Hollywood 10 in 1947, and then they refused on constitutional grounds, First Amendment freedom of expression. They said nobody has the right to ask me who I vote for or what my religion is. And, you know, or what my political beliefs are. So they said, well, contempt. And it took 3 years for it to work up to the Supreme Court. And by 1950, there had been two major changes. There had been several replacements on the Supreme Court. It moved further right. And we'd gone to war in Korea. And so the Supreme Court just kicked the can down the road. They didn't find for or against the argument. They just didn't hear the case. And instantly, within weeks, these 10 men went off to jail for six-month terms. And there's a lot of, maybe this is Jewish, or maybe it's just black humor, you know, but it's there. By the time that Ring Lardner and Herbert Biberman went to the federal prison in Texas, they knew someone in that prison. The guy who'd been the chairman of the committee who held them in contempt had already been jailed for fraud in his feather bedding his office and hiring relatives who didn't even know where Washington was. Mm-hmm. And he was in prison, and he was worried that they were gonna hurt him. Anyway, so the book, so that was 1950, and now my book is set in 1959, and it's starting to wane, but it's hard. It's writers are able to write at bargain price and bargain based on prices, for, you know, under other names and so on. The directors weren't as lucky. You have to, if you're directing, you've got to be on the set. Likewise, the performers. So it was But it was starting to open, but really the cusp was, the turning point was Trumbo, who, Dalton Trumbo had been the highest priced writer in Hollywood, maybe the most gifted, had won the Academy Award before the war for Kitty Foyle. And just by dint of his output and his mischievousness, he was just such a, he made it, any time there was a good script written in Hollywood, someone would say, I bet Dalton did that. And they'd come and say, did you do that? And he'd say, gee, I never talk about that.
Maybe.
Maybe. And therefore, so if the illusion got to be that he, anything that was being done, you know, there was a value was being done by him. And then in 1959 into 60, there were two producers who took the chance, because no one knew how terrible the results of bucking the blacklist would be. But Kirk Douglas put Trumbo's name on Spartacus, and Otto Preminger did it on Exodus. And all the people that were supposed to come out and pick it and scream, and they would be, you know, make sure that the pictures would fail. They didn't get their scripts. They didn't show up. And both pictures were enormous hits. And so at least Dalton was back in business. And some other people came through well. And it went away. But to this day, there are still people, of those that are alive still, or the children of, which was what fascinated me, because one of the children of the blacklist was my closest friend, who just died a few weeks ago. Mm. I already dedicated the book to him, but it's, you know. But
yeah, well, your novel, it's a little bit of Shakespeare. This is kind of like a Romeo and Juliet kind of thing. And there's a little dash.
That's a good story.
Yeah, there's a little dash of Hamlet in there. And a little Dorothy Hughes. Maybe a little Dorothy Hughes.
I like a dash of Hamlet.
Yeah. And now you have, your story is told in three sides. You've got the son of a blacklisted writer, the daughter of a friendly witness, right, and the police lieutenant obsessed with his capture. Oh, no, that's the fugitive. But it's like that. It's the FBI agent who's telling the story. So why did you want to tell it from the three sides?
It just felt, well, it's a little bit, it's sort of Rashomon. You can kind of deal with the same events and yet see three very different viewpoints of it, because it's somewhat, the initial thing that drew me to it was the children of, and this was, it's not, Romeo and Juliet, the families didn't agree. Well, one father gave names and prospered, and his daughter stayed a princess, as he was a prince, and his father, the boy's father, didn't, and the mother killed herself, and the father went to Europe and took the son along with him, which was the pathway that Eric Bercovici, and his father was Leonardo Bercovici, who wrote such scandalously political pictures as The Bishop's Wife and Portrait of Jenny. You know,
I love that.
Yes. Yeah, he was a
lover. Both fantasies. He wrote a lot of fantasies, huh?
Yep.
Well, but by having
the viewpoints.
The FBI character in there, too.
He became the biggest surprise. You know, you hear writers talking about when the characters take over. And his name, he's an FBI agent, and he was, as he describes himself, he says he was the head of the commie chasing squad for Hoover. If you're going to tell a story about the House Un-American Activities Committee, you're going to serve subpoenas. If you're going to serve subpoenas, you're going to have an FBI agent. So there was always going to be an FBI agent. And my first thought was that it is like Javert. The son comes back now to town, and it's like, he who plagued the father is now going to plague the son, and so on. But essentially, he was as I look back, initially he was a function. But he became like the second or third most important character in the book, and really carries a lot of the moral questions of the second half of the book, particularly, because it's kind of to have someone from the left say, "Oh my God, blacklisting is a terrible thing. It crushes people. It destroys lives," you know, and so on, is one way to go about it. But it felt a little sort of like preaching. I have that stuff too, but it's, yes, it's like preaching to the choir. But but he winds up feeding a line just to getting an attaboy, to getting a pat on the head from J. Edgar Hoover, who says, "Well, who do you think did it?" And he says, "Well, it could be this kid." And he's given a name. And he doesn't realize it, but in that moment he's given a name.
He named a name.
He named a name, and he comes to realize how difficult it is to try to take the name back.
To unname it.
To unname it. You can't do that. And then you up the stakes on him, because if he stays in the naming names business, he could have all kinds of good things happen in his life, or you could make the boss mad. And
so he finds himself in the same dilemma as these other two.
Yes.
Well, Jerry Ludwig, in this book, Blacklist, you begin your book with a quote from Kazan.
Yes.
I think I have it right here.
And it's a good quote.
It is, and it's Kazan's sort of...
mea culpa.
Yeah. I did what I did because it was the most tolerable of two alternatives that were either way painful, even disastrous, and either way wrong for me. That's what a difficult decision means. Either way you go, you lose. But by having Kazan in the epigraph of your book and having an FBI agent, is your book more sympathetic to the other side, to the right side, than you would think it was going to be? Or
no, I wish there was a... Well, I don't want to give away the book, but I think McKenna becomes a very rich character. And Kazan I love Kazan, and I knew him briefly, and I think I can watch his movies and do watch them endlessly. This idea of, you know, I don't like someone, so I don't want to see their movies. But I can't quite come to terms with... I've come to understand why he did Character is Destiny, and when you look back, he came from an oppressed minority in Europe and is descended, so I could see how he came to do what he did. On the other hand, what he did do was he chose, finally, not initially. Initially, he refused to give names in executive session, and then he was pressured, and what he was looking at was he wanted to make movies, not a crime, and not particularly a blessing with the quality, because some of his best work came on the waterfront in East of Eden, and Based on the Crowd came after he had testified.
Right.
But he realized that if he took a hard line and said, I take the Fifth Amendment, go on, blacklist me, he would not be able to make movies, at least in this country, or probably anywhere else, possibly, because some of the John Berry went to France and made French movies, and so on. But the distribution companies, MGM had an MGM London and Paris and so on. So if you were blacklisted, you were really blacklisted. And he wanted to make movies, and he had something to offer, certainly. But on the other hand, he was such a towering figure in American culture at that point, Kazan. He was the number one director on Broadway, where he probably, but who knows, you know, no guarantees, he might have been able to keep on working, even though he couldn't work in movies. And he was the number one movie director. And if he had said, I refuse to answer the questions, and I take the Fifth Amendment, money grubbing being what it is, would there have been a producer in Hollywood or one distribution company that wasn't doing well that year that said, to hell with the blacklist, let's give Gadget a camera and let him make some money for us? He might have alone made a difference.
He was powerful enough that he might have.
He might have, if he'd gone back to work, that would have been, the balloon would have a little hole in it, and maybe it would have made the thing last a little less the length it did.
Well, it's an endlessly fascinating era, and it's fun to have a murder mystery set there. And the book is called Blacklist, and it's a novel by my guest Jerry Ludwig. Jerry, thanks so much for talking to us here on From the Bookshelf.
A pleasure. Thank you. Good to see you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time, and you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at FromTheBookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Jerry Ludwig. His new novel is called Blacklist. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.